Okay, today is, what is today, February 25th?
Yep.
2012. I'm here with Jim Anderson in our continuing series about his aircraft mechanic career. I guess, if it's all right with you, we could start with the Tenoda Lake story. That's a pretty early one in your career.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I hadn't even got my A&P license at that time. But, let's see, to start it off, I guess, it's a fellow landed, passenger in the back, sack of dog food on his lap, on the ice of Tenoda Lake in the fall. And he came in close to the shore, it stopped, and it fell through. I got both guys out, got out okay. So then the thought was, well, we got to get the airplane out. And the first fellow that went down there was Glenn Gregory. And he saw it a circle around the airplane and a channel back through the ice, and they winched it back as far as they could go to the shoreline until the landing gear hit the bottom and it couldn't move. So this is November. It started freezing up a little solider and solider. The airplane, let's see, the trailing edge of the wings were out of the ice, and the tail wheel was out of the ice, sitting on maybe a 20-degree angle. So we decided we have to go down there and finish this job, and loaded up a gull-wing Stinson with everything we needed, and crashed off the end of the runway at Phillips Field in Fairbanks due to several little things that weren't quite right. Let's see, Glenn got a dinged up ankle. I didn't get hurt at all. There's nothing worse than sound in this world when you're sitting in a wrecked airplane hearing things sizzle. It wasn't fire gas. It was snow all over the engine. Anyhow, I got out of that. I started wading over to the road to get some help. The first man I'd seen was an FAA inspector wanting to know what happened. I says, oh, I'll go over to the hangar, get the Jeep, and tell him we're all right. Ran back through the woods and said, we have to get some of this freight out of here because we were quite overloaded. So we hid a bunch of stuff in the bushes for a while. And everything was weighed. We were 30 pounds overweight, no problem there, instead of about 300. But I went down later with a truck to Gocona and flew and picked up Art Smith at Delta and flew in from Gocona in a Cub. Tenoda Lake's a beautiful spot. It's up high in the mountains. Absolutely glare ice. We slid for miles after we landed on skis. And, you know, we get to working on the airplane. It was it's a bit of a problem because there's ice inside the wings. There's ice inside the fuselage. And the engine's underwater, of course. And you're trying to figure out how to get this all thawed out. We can't do much. There's ice around the struts. And Art was talking about blackfish, which school up in the winter, and they'll keep a open hole in the ice. And all of a sudden, he says, hey, you got an outboard. We rigged up an outboard behind the wing and stirred up the water, and it just melted that ice like you wouldn't believe. It was fantastic. So the next thing here, built a fire on shore with a 50-gallon drum, filled it with water and started heating it up. I'm going up and down that lake, pushing an old dog sled, trying to find wood. Then we're carrying hot water. We'll cut some holes in the tops of the wings, carrying water over, and pour it in there so we can melt that out. And finally got squared away enough to put a tripod down into the bottom, and hooked onto the engine and lifted it up. Covered it all up with everything we could find, canvas and tarps and quilts and everything, and put a couple of fire pots underneath it and kept it warm all night long. And some of this is going on. Art, who was actually a fairly heavy guy, crawled all through the fuselage on that, drilling holes in the tubing with a twist drill, what we call the egg beater drill, to get the water out before it could freeze. This was a big problem. The engine wasn't too bad. Let's see, took the carburetor off or just drained it. And took the magnetos off, put a spare set on. Everything worked out fine. So some years later, I remember talking to the owner, and he said that they had finally had to recover it. The fabric was getting bad. and they only found one tube that had split from water. It was just one tube that Art had missed. It was fantastic. Oh, yeah. It was up to, what, 6-7 days, I guess.
How many inches of ice were on the lake by the time
you
got there?
Shoot. There was a good foot of ice, probably more. Yeah, because we were walking all around. We had to watch it after the outboard was so efficient that we actually melted too much. But the weather was pretty decent, so by covering the wings up at night when we did sleep, they didn't refreeze. So this worked out pretty nicely.
You were able to stay at the lodge there in the evening?
Yeah, the lodge is right, well, yeah, we're right out in front of it. And so we stayed there. Mrs. Conkle was cooking and Bud was helping and everything worked out pretty well.
Was Mr. Conkle the owner of the lodge?
He was, yeah, he had the lodge and the plane and everything, yeah.
And this is up in the Wrangell St. Elias Range?
I think so, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I wasn't too good at my geography then. I was about 18, I think, mm-hmm. Something like that.
And this would have been 56, 53, somewhere?
No, let's see, late 55, mm-hmm. October, November 55. Oh, yeah. And the worst part of the trip was driving the truck back. And we forget to call it canyon, just below Black Rapids. It was starting to blow and drizzle, and I'm banging and crashing through there. And I stopped and figured, well, I'll get out and check the load. Of course, the only thing missing was my sleeping bag, big one. And I'm standing behind the truck, and it starts rolling and went in the ditch. Nice, wide, shallow ditch, and I'm standing there, actually was taking a leak at the time. I ran up and got things back ordered and looked around and tried to figure this out. It was pretty flat there, so I drove off in the tundra and turned around and banged up onto the road and finally got home. And good thing I did at the time, because it turned 40 below right after that.
What were the temperatures when you were out there recovering the plane?
Oh, they were pretty nice. I don't think we ever checked a thermometer to speak of, but they couldn't have been more than 10, 15 below, something like that. And the weather was pretty good. And, of course, I was young and eager and didn't even notice that, you know. Art Smith was quite a character. Every night he would take his cigar, which was only about an inch or two left, and put it in a spot in the log there by his bunk. And in the morning he'd sit there with that little stubby piece of yesterday's cigar trying to light it and not burn his nose. Yeah, he'd been around a lot. Learned a lot from him. Real good guy.
Was he one of the mechanics down there at Fairbanks?
No. He lived in Delta. And, let's see. Seems like he was flying hunters and things off of Summit Lake in the summer and in the fall. Mm-hmm. Fishermen and hunters. Mm-hmm. And he kind of just rebuilt an airplane or two in Delta. Did various things during the winter. Always busy with something.
Was he a big game guide? Or
no, just pilot. Yeah, just those days he just flew people out and they went hunting. Yeah.
I suppose finding a way to make a living in Delta in the 50s was
pretty low key, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, well, he was one of those guys who could do most anything, so it didn't bother him much. He just didn't want to live in town. Mm-hmm. And he had 5 girls and 1 boy, I think, running around.
Safest place for him is a place like Delta.
I expect. Oh, yes, all gone now.
So the Cub, it was a Cub, correct?
Yeah, Super Cub, Super yeah. Cub. Very expensive airplane at that time, you know. A brand new one was almost $5,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have been 55.
And a Super Cub today will cost you?
Oh, a Cub Crafter's a couple hundred thousand. Mm-hmm.
Probably the same vintage, too, huh?
No, they build new ones, or they take old ones and completely rebuild them. You know, they start in with the data plate and go from there. They're beautiful airplanes, but I don't know why anybody would pay a couple hundred thousand for a two-place airplane. to each his own.
Of course, the whole economics of being a recreational pilot have changed to the point that it's you pretty much have to have a good income to fund your hobby at this point.
Oh, my, yes. As a miner friend of mine told me, he says, oh, back in the 60s, it took about an ounce of gold to buy a couple of drums of fuel oil. And it still costs an ounce of gold to get a couple of drums of fuel oil to their mine. Yeah. So the only thing that changed is the numbers.
It kind of always surprised me how, as expensive as small planes are, if you go down to Dietrich Auto or something here in town, which I guess closed, the shop rate's $95 an hour.
Yeah.
But you don't see, maybe the machinist union mechanics for Boeing working on Dreamliners make $100,000 a year, but the guys running a small shop like yours, your shop rate still isn't.
Well, my shop rate was 80. Mm-hmm. And we did well at that, but I owned it. I didn't have any payments to make or anything else. Mm-hmm. Some of the others are at 100, 105. Mm. I haven't checked lately what anybody's charging. Mm. The wages for aircraft mechanics have never been where they actually belong, get right down to it. Mm. But the government, in its wisdom, decided that aircraft mechanics were semi-skilled labor because there was no apprenticeship programs, no this, no that. There was a bunch of reasons for it. The main reason being that the government and the airlines were really wheeling and dealing in the old days when the government passed out routes and did this and did that. And it was a bureaucratic thing, I suppose. And airlines consider the mechanic as a necessary evil.
How about the story? Was it a C-46 up there out of Livengood?
Yeah, yeah.
What, tell me what you thought about that.
That was an interesting one. The airplane went to Anaktuvik with a load of drums, fuel and gas. And the pilot couldn't get in, so he came back and he ran out of gas and skidded it up the side of a mountainside above the tree line, I think it was. Sure, there wasn't a tree there. You know, we went up there with a couple trucks and a cat and a front-end loader. Plowed our way up to the airplane. Walked over the top of the ridge to look at it, and my partner in crime, Arnie Lake, looks at it and he says, Jim, we've made a mistake. It was sitting there on its belly, snow blown all over it. It was a miserable-looking sight. Anyhow, we got to working on it, set up a tent that squared away, kind of built a road to it with the cat. There were two other fellows involved with the equipment. So we had these airbags, about 12 foot square. And we got those under the wings and started to lift it. It doesn't take much pressure with that much area. And then we found out we had to do something else because the airplane started to slide downhill. So we tied the cat to one engine and the cat to the other, loader to the other one, however it worked out. Started to lift. Now we found out the tail's going to come up and nothing else. We had to load some drums back into it. We finally get her up high enough to where we get the landing gear down and in place. And from then on, it was just a matter of... When was it? There was another problem, too. Oh, yeah, when it skidded up the hillside, the belly ruptured out in the front end, and all of the baggage compartments up forward were filled full of packed, hard-packed snow. So while I was working on the props and doing this and that, we had to disassemble them. Arnie was in there shoveling and digging and scratching. And then finally we put a Herman Nelson heater in there to get the last to melt it out. Mm. And it was just tons of it. Miserable. And then came the day that, okay, we can probably fly it off tomorrow. You get word back that, oh yes, King Williams will be right up there and get it. And he is the fellow that wrecked it in the first place. And I said, no, you get this ween captain named Don Gilbertson. I know how good he is. And get him to get it back to Fairbanks. So that's the way it worked off. Went down that mountain and off, and away it went. I found out later that, let's see, what was his name? Called him Brownie. He was flying the airplane out of Anchorage over to Beluga, some native village, hauling fuel. And he says he landed and the right gear collapsed and everything went downhill from there and it caught fire and burned up.
Oh, boy.
He says, the right gear, isn't that something? Yes, he said, I'd had a few problems with it before. Everybody said something that was kind of slow acting. And he said, well, we had to pull that landing gear down into place with a come along, but I don't think they fixed it. Mm-hmm. It just didn't do it.
Oh, jeez.
So years later, it caught up to it the way it went.
So you had replaced the props, the blades anyways.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have to do a checkout on the engines at that point in the field just to make sure a crank wasn't bent or something? Mm-hmm. Were the props turning when he bellied in?
Just barely. It wasn't bad. Mm-hmm. It curves. Everything was even, so I didn't have any problems with that. We ran them up to see if there was any oil leaks, anything like that. We didn't get any, but one cooler started leaking on the way to town, and it was only a 20-25 minute hop. So, I just didn't show up. Probably wasn't bypassing. When we started, we probably didn't run it long enough. Didn't have too much gas there with us.
Was the belly ruptured? And all that snow packed in, did you have to repair the sheet metal on the bottom?
Not
of that?
Not for a flight like that. It wasn't hurt that badly. There was no structural. It was all just the metal itself, stringers. But no, we didn't have to fix anything there.
How long of a strip did you have? You had just bulldozed it on the tundra for him to take off?
Yeah, just went right downhill with it. Everything looked fine. Pilot said, oh, that's plenty. Empty C-46, get off very short. And built like a bunch of big tires, everything else. It went off nicely.
The gear was up when he came in?
No, he left the gear down on the way into town.
I mean when he ran out of fuel and landed?
No, he had the wheels up, yeah.
Wheels up.
Yeah. But something got twisted in the right side, nobody fixed. Oh, yes.
Had you used airbags before in recovering aircraft?
Or? Yeah, one out in front of the Ween hangar, or the terminal at the airport. I was working for Ween's at the time on night shift, and one of the planes had come in, something had happened, and one gear collapsed right in front of the terminal, pretty much. So, of course, the airport's closed and everything else. And I was lead man on the graveyard shift. One of the guys comes by, and he says, you know, we got everything pretty well taken care of. Let's go look at that 46. Maybe we can do something. So we chewed the fat a minute and went and got one airbag. The whole crew went roaring out there and we lifted her all up and put the gear down and towed it off. And in the morning comes by and the foreman and I guess he'd be assistant director of maintenance showed up and they're going to go work on that 46 and get it fixed. And they're looking around, it's gone. But what happened? Oh, we had some spare time so we just fixed it. Yeah, that was my first experience with them. It wasn't, they worked very well. Something like that. One problem you had is when you lifted it, you put the airbags in pretty close and covered up the jack points. So you had, and then you couldn't get, couldn't get quite high enough, so you had to deflate the gear and get it up tight so it would swing down in place. But that's about the only thing. And of course, the further out you went, the higher you had to go, so that everything was kind of cobbled together that way.
On that C-46 at Livengood, were any of the instruments? I was just trying to think back on some of the pictures. It seems like a bunch of snow blew inside the cockpit.
Oh yeah, they left the cockpit door open, but it thawed out. Everything worked good enough to get to town. All you really need is airspeed and engine instruments, altimeter, something like that.
That was a... Who was the owner of the aircraft that season?
Fairbanks Air Service,
okay.
Yeah.
Was that prior to you and Don Gilbertson's joint venture with the bombers?
Let's see. Trying to think of this. It was later on. I think we were mixed up in them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty sure, yeah, because I'd left Wings. Mm-hmm. And I was working at Fairbanks Air Service a bit. And some other people just dinging around. Carrying on. Let's see now. It's before I got married. No, my gosh. It's hard to say. I can't really remember. I've never thought of it before.
A lot of events, a lot of aircraft events in your life to try to sort out, put in order. It's got to be.
Yeah. It all kind of flops around together.
You know, Doug Millard talked about somewhere when I was talking to him. He had a story about a C-46 that he lost a gear on. Although I think he ended up on the side of the runway.
Well, that was. It was off the side a little bit, but it still blocked the runway. I don't know if Doug was flying that one or not.
Yeah, I wonder if...
I don't know. Just let go.
So how about the Beaver north of Arctic Village?
Oh, that was a son of a gun. Mainly because of the weather. But the fella had gone to land at the village, and it was too much fog from the smoke off the wood stoves and all, so... He elected to land upriver, and then he would taxi down. But my understanding is that the flap selector, he still had it in the up position. And when he went to land, he started pumping, and of course the flaps went up, and the airplane fell out of the sky. It kind of tore the right gear a bit loose and bent the outboard section of the right wing. That was about it. It wasn't too bad. Anyhow, Ween sent an insurance agent, a member of the pilots' union, and me to go take a look at this to see what I thought about it. Well, as it turned out, we had to stop back at Circle because the weather was getting bad and it was dark and everything, so we stayed at Circle Hot Springs that night. And we're sitting there having a beer, and I'm happily riding away, and the FAA fellow that was there, he says, "Well, what are you doing, Jimmy?" I said, "I'll figure out how to get it out of there. It shouldn't be too bad." And he shook his head. The prop wasn't even hurt, mind you. So, he kind of thought that was sort of neat and showed him what I had planned. I get back to town and I told the boss, the director, maintenance director, that, yeah, I could get it out. It shouldn't be any problem. Just take one guy with me and it wouldn't be bad. And that fella really made me angry. He says, "If it doesn't work out, burn it right there." That was the wrong thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got back up there with all the stuff. We made a piece of aluminum plate, probably 3 foot, 4 foot square, 3x4, something like that. And we formed it a bit to a beaver wing right there in Fairbanks. And we took that up. The wing was bent outboard of the strut about a 30-degree angle. We got some ropes around the wingtip, hooked them onto a barrel of gas, and Spanish windlass them down as far as we could get it. Then we went and put this plate on, which fit pretty good, hand-drilled with no electric drills, naturally, no battery packs, none of that, and screwed it all down in place and ran some cables in from the tip down to a point on the fuselage to give it a little more support. For the just in case. And jacked it up a bit and got the gear lined up and kind of cabled it into place. Around the upper fitting, it was still pretty solid. It had moved, but seemed solid enough. And then came the worst part. We had figured, well, we can go down to the village now and get in touch with somebody. We've been here, what, 2-3 days? And the warmest we saw it was 35 below in the middle of the day. Oh, my, it was cold. We had one Herman Nelson. Luckily, it kept working. We went to leave, packed up our tent and all our gear, and it wouldn't move. The skis were frozen down. So nothing to do but put the wheels down, get the skis up as high as we could, and clean those off. And we didn't have any camp left, so I taxied the damn thing about 10 miles downriver, which felt like 100. The river twists and turns like a snake, and we're bellowing in the dark with the wing light on and frost hanging all over everything. And by gosh, here's somebody out there with a lantern waving at us, and we skidded to a halt. Get the batteries out, drained the oil, took them over to the schoolhouse where they stay warm. And the next morning, we stayed in the schoolhouse that night. The next morning, go down and take a look at things. And much to my surprise, I was so confused with all these turns in that river. It was on the wrong side of the river, and it was facing the wrong direction. Of all things, I was that, after going around that many corners, it was just going continually after the other. If I'd have known how to find Fort Yukon, I'd have probably taken off. But pitch black at night, that wouldn't have been too smart either.
And it was, while you were taxing down the river, it was dark and winding around.
Yeah, this is November. We spent Thanksgiving there. Arrow Hill was my partner's name. We spent Thanksgiving at the village there at the Army with a big party. A good time. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Why did you select Arrow to go with you?
Arrow was a heavy guy, strong. He had enough smart. He knew how to handle himself in the cold weather. He wasn't going to make any big deals. I didn't think he'd argue with me. We were pretty good friends, and he was easy going. What works horrible on those, you get in there and start working in there, somebody else decides he can do it differently or better, and then you're at loggerheads, and that's no good. There's one guy who's got to say, we're going to do it this way, and if it don't work, shift gears and go the other way. But you got to start somewhere and get going, and then figure out your planning. Get a rough idea of what to do, and then sometimes, mostly you have to modify them a bit. But it's a challenging sort of a thing. And of course, it pays better than working 8 hours a night. Oh, yes. It's quite a trip.
How often in your times in the field where you're going to recover a damaged aircraft do you find yourself using whatever happens to be laying around, pieces of spruce tree or?
Oh, not usually. The best thing is to go in and take a look at it and figure out what you need and then come back. If someone comes in and says the airplane's wrecked, we'll take you out there, you've got to fix it, then you find out what's wrong with it, but they don't see what you do because they're a pilot, not a mechanic. There's things that you don't take because you don't think you need them, and all of a sudden you find out that, holy mackerel, you forgot to tell me about this or that or something else. I have gone out cold turkey a lot of times. Spruce trees. Used part of the only spruce tree on that Arctic Village trip to jam up underneath because of the tail. I didn't realize until later that the tail wheel was all screwed up. So I lashed some spruce back in there to keep it down in place. But generally not.
The image I had that struck me is there's a picture in your collection of pictures where you're working on Sandy Jameson's plane and you've got you're using it like a drift.
That's what it was for, yeah. I was straightening out a rib a little bit and trying to get things formed up a little bit. That picture, oof. My wife sent that picture to some relatives in Germany, and I guess it got over all over the country.
Are you good, or can you go for another story? Did you want to take a little break, or?
I should run out and take a leak, and then
okay. The pump will go better again. That was a little airbag thing.
we're back recording again.
So you're just mentioning a C-46. I'm going to have you repeat that so I can capture it on the recorder.
Yeah, I forgot about it. Didn't get the wheels down on the 46 right at International at the north end and skidded to a halt. And the somebody called me up and says, "Jesus, you got this and that, you've done this before." I said, "Yeah." And go to Wien's and get the airbags, and wherever they are. And there's people all around this thing. It was an Interior Airways airplane. And everybody's trying to do this and that and something else. I finally got around, I got hold of the head security cop. And I said, "You tell these people that I'm in charge, we'll do it my way, I've done it before." And still had to argue with some of them because they knew better. And the classic there was the airplane was empty. You know, I got the air started into the bags, we got them positioned. And they said, "We're going to need about 6-8 guys back in the back end of the airplane, what you call the orchestra pit, after the door." And a bunch of them climbed in there, including the fellow that was working with me at the time, Dale Briggs. And we commenced to put the air to it. And this same thing, the tail will come up first. It's starting up a little bit, and all of a sudden this tail starts going, "What's going on here?" Back, I said, "What's going on, Dale?" He says, "They all left. The minute it started moving, they all jumped out." So then when they grabbed another guy, and I said, "Go down and get us some, about 3-4 barrels, full barrels, bring them up and load them in the back." And then on it was no problem at all. But everybody's, "Well, you got to do this and you got to do that." And I said, It don't work. "We're going to put jacks on it." I said, "No, the jack point's up above the airbag, idiot. How do you do that?" It was just amazing. So many people got so smart. Mm. But that was a quick and easy one. But that's about, was it 3 airplanes I lifted of those bags. Don't know whatever became of them. They were going to store them down at the security, aircraft security, what do they call it, fire station. But I never had another one after that, so I don't know.
Who bought the bags, or who originally brought them up?
Originally they were Wien's. Mm-hmm. Probably came from Army Surplus. A lot of stuff came from Surplus at Wien's. Mm-hmm. Including the airplanes, the 46s.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, they were all of them. And gosh, I remember when they first, after the end of the war, there was a bunch of non-skeds. They were flying C-46s, Seattle, Fairbanks, stopping in Net Island to fuel up. Mm-hmm. And it was, $67 to fly south. Mm-hmm. But they said, "Okay, well, we're trying for this day. We got to get so many customers." And then they'd go and they had a load. And there would be combination. You'd be riding there, and it'd be load of freight along one wall, and you'd be sitting on the other side. It was, according to everybody these days, absolutely unsafe, but it worked at that time. I don't know what happened in between.
Mm. So speaking of infield recoveries, and we mentioned the Sandy Jameson picture of you with the pieces of spruce. What was the plane, and where was that at, and what was the circumstances?
Headwaters of the Colleen River. Landing on gravel bars, hunting season. And the right landing gear. The gear leg broke right down near the axle. Of course, that got the right wing and got the prop. And Sandy came over and he's telling me about this, and he says, "Would you please come up there?" I was having trouble with my knees. They were pretty well used up and hurting. And I did not want to go. And then he kept talking, and I said, "Oh, fine." I said, "Okay, we'll do it. And I'll rig up something." So I made up some angle iron and bought a bunch of parts and pieces, Schedule 8 rod and everything. Got up there and looked. I said, "Oh, this ain't too bad." And some other people had been up, looked already, and sent me some pictures of it. Here again, the one thing was missing. Both the fittings for the brakes at the gear were broken off, which I didn't know until I got there. But with the hunting season going on, that wasn't any problem. There was somebody came by and dropped them off for us. But I got the gear lashed back into it and cabled up and fixed the wing. I had some, Sandy was looking for it. You got to have an aileron. I says, it won't do as much good. The wing's bent. It won't fit. We got to use what we got here. So I straightened it a bit. And one of the better materials to take with you for leading edge damage is stovepipe, because it's already half formed and you can take quite a bit in a small bundle. So I made up a stovepipe leading edge for about 4 feet. The picture of me hammering in there with a piece of spruce pole was to get the rib to push out some of the old metal a little bit. It looked rather crude, I suppose, a 4-pound hammer and a spruce pole, but it worked. And taped up a little bit of the wing tip and everything, and actually you'll take a picture of it, and from one angle it looked like there was nothing wrong. And Sandy flew it back into town. I came in with another guy to Fort Yukon, and I told Sandy, he was talking about Fort Yukon, I says, now I'll go to Circle because there's a road if something goes wrong or things aren't right, we can take it apart and haul it in. And I told the pilot on the Twin, we were coming back from Fort Yukon to here at Fairbanks, what was going on, and he says, oh, okay, by gosh, the wheels barely came up, and he's leaning around, he says, your partner's taking off a Circle right now. Well, that's good. So then he drug me up to let me come up forward and tell him what was happening, shot the breeze a bit.
What kind of plane was that Sandy?
A 170.
170, okay.
Yeah.
Is Sandy a artist?
Yes.
Because there was something in the paper last week about Sandy Jameson. I didn't really know if it was the same.
Oh, yeah. He's quite a guy. He's an artist. And he's a carpenter and a half. And a guide. Just does all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Very small, lightweight guy.
And that, and the pictures from that recovery, you were staying in a tent. How long were you guys up there?
Oh, we got in the first night. There was a camp there already. We stayed there. But that was quite a distance from the airplane. So the next morning we flew down there. And the Cub was there. And then down to the sandbar, or the gravel bar, actually. And then set up a tent down there. It was only there, one night. Well, 2 nights. The first night, Shikora's camp. And the second night was down at the airplane.
Shikora... Fairbanks Shikora?
Yes. Yeah, uh-huh. They go up hunting there every year. Mm-hmm. Up the upper end of the Colleen River.
Why do I know the name Shikora? Wrestling? Maybe a wrestling coach at some point in Fairbanks?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Family's been around it for ages.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. It was beautiful country up there.
That's the Brooks Range, correct?
Yeah, just across the Brooks, just across the mountains right there, everything flowed into the Arctic Ocean. The Colleen, of course, flows down and finally ends up going out the Yukon. Mm-hmm. And flying back, I'm in Fort Yukon. I was in 185, and I can't remember the pilot's name, Frank something it was. And we're sitting there. God, it's a beautiful day, and I'm admiring the country. He says, that went quite a well. He says, I expect you've done this before. And I'm sitting there for a minute thinking about it, and I says, yeah, I was about 18 on the first one. Dead silence. He just looked at me. That was it.
I suppose, needless to say, the winter type recoveries are always, or repairs are more difficult if you're out in the field.
Just due to the weather, yeah. You got to spend more time taking care of yourself. Because, mm-hmm. You know, if you goof up and saw on your hand or smash something or something falls on you, you're in deep trouble. So you got to watch it real close. And the cold weather just slows everything down anyhow. Summer, it's bugs. Mosquitoes by the jillions.
On the Beaver Arctic Village, were there villagers coming up and checking on you? Or?
Yeah, we were there about 2-3 nights. And I think every night somebody came up, and the dog team would show up, get to talk a bit, carry on. It's all right. It's Bob getting the oil pump.
Okay. Is Bob the one who has the little curling bear dog?
Yeah.
Yeah, I met him out here the other morning.
Yeah.
I was just thinking back on the pictures. You have one picture. It looks like it's on the coast. I don't know that it's necessarily a recovery of a wrecked aircraft, but it's a big plane with twin tails, and you're putting the tail assembly.
Oh, that was at Nelson Lagoon.
Where is Nelson Lagoon?
It's on the Alaska Peninsula, about halfway from Port Hyden and Cold Bay, about in between. Mm-hmm. Nice little place, one of the nicest villages I've ever been in. Fishermen mostly. But they'd taken a C-82 in to pick up some freight or deliver something. And it landed just a trifle short and kind of bounced, did something. And you know, the boom kinked, the right-hand boom on the C-82. So we got another one here and got it down there. Me and Kevin Stalder on that, and two mechanics from, it was Northern Air Cargo. And they told us, oh yeah, there's a crane there and everything, they're just unloading stuff. And oh yeah, okay. There was no crane. We had a bit of a painter scaffold. And we found out those booms have to come from the top down because of the angles things are at. So luckily we had everything kind of rigged and we're trying to figure out what the hell are we going to do here. In came a fish and game airplane with about four people on it. We put them right to work and got that thing wrestling. It's a massive piece of stuff. Lightweight, though. It's pretty light. Anyhow, we got it down into place and then riveted it all together and flew it back. Well, it was, we were there for 4 or 5 days. Pretty good, though. Had an apartment, everything.
Does the structural part of that bolt together? Was it a section that you could detach?
And oh, yeah, yeah. The front end and rear end are all bolted. There was enough we could swing the stabilizer section. We left it all attached to the left-hand boom, but we could get it back a ways. And the front, of course, there was bolts and rivets. Yeah, they were riveting up there quite a while. Well, Kevin and I were fixing the engine mount. So that all worked out pretty well. Ricardo Lopez, and what's the other fellow's name? Ricardo was the sheet metal man. Very good. Can't think of that fellow's name right off.
Were these local guys?
No, they were out of Anchorage. They were Northern Air Cargo mechanics. Mm. Oh, yeah.
So if Northern Air Cargo had their mechanics, they counted on you for some jobs?
Bobby Schulten, well, on that one was kind of odd because Bob Schulten had owned it. He was pretty sick with cancer at the time, and he says, called up and told him what was going on. I said, well, okay, and then I thought I'd better check in with their director of maintenance. The one I had been dealing with wasn't there anymore, and this new guy says, we don't need you, yes, man, okay, so much for that. Then I got to thinking about it, and I said, I better call up Bobby and tell him what's going on. I did, and he says, you get your stuff down here to Anchorage and your partner. I want a bush mechanic out there, not hangar mechanics, and that was the difference. So away we went.
Yeah, your view of the world changes dramatically once you're on the field.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's completely different. The one fellow, and I can't say his name, I know him real well, but he'd been out on some of these before and worked with him before. Mm-hmm. An engine change at Tanana. I guess that was it. That was nice when we got to stay in the hospital there. It was warm, too. Cold outside, though.
What were you changing an engine on in Tanana?
C-82. Had a bunch of tripods and stuff. The engine's way up there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you don't just change the engine. You change the oil tank, the cooler, everything.
Mm-hmm. Was this an engine that just went bad?
It just went bad, yeah. And you know, all the time I worked around with Schulten, I used to take care of the planes when they came through here. And I only know them in all the time they flew those airplanes, over 20, 25 years, there was only two engine failures. That was one of them, and I guess there was one somewhere else I heard about later. But that was it.
That's pretty good.
Oh, they took good care of those things, really good. But then Bobby died, and he was the guy that knew how to do things. I don't know who was running the place at the time, but the FAA descended upon them, and they had to park them. They were too old, and this and that, and something else. They were in wonderful condition. But, of course, Interior Airways at that time had Herc's, and they didn't want CD2s flying around, hauling freight that they could get. Politics.
What's the...
So Northern Air Cargo didn't slow down. They went right to DC-6s and kept hauling everything they could anyhow.
So you actually worked kind of independently for a lot of the outfits in the interior.
Yeah.
More than just the small aircraft, the Cubs and stuff, through your own private shop, but through for some of these other airlines.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The small ones, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the ones we're passing through. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I'll have to bring down. I ordered off a used bookstore some maps the other day. Some of them are 1913 quadrangles of Fairbanks. And
oh.
They've got the old railroad, the old Tano Railroad, mm-hmm, and stuff. But I also got, in that packet of things, there was like nine maps. There's a fare schedule from Alaska Airlines in 49 or something, 1949. I didn't even know Alaska Airlines was operating.
Oh, they operated from way back in the 30s.
Yeah. But it's...
No, it was later than that. No, it wasn't either. Alaska Airlines was operating out of Weeks Field when I was a little kid. So that had to be, early 40s. Mm-hmm. At one time, they had 36 Gullwing Stinsons running around the country.
Wow. in Alaska?
Yeah.
Huh.
Oh, yeah.
I actually have a book on Alaska Airlines that I have yet to read because it's in my stack of books, mm-hmm, to read on the story. I'm kind of familiar, obviously, with the Wing story because my dad was a Wing pilot.
Yeah.
Just experienced them, but I'm not familiar with the Alaska Airlines story. I'd be interested.
Yeah, and the other outfit, of course, with Northern Consolidated, and that was a group of bush pilots that got together and put that up, and mm-hmm, the name Ray Peterson. Mm-hmm. He'd flown Anchorage to Bethel a lot, and somehow he got to be the boss of that outfit.
Mm-hmm. And Jorgie flew for...
Oh, I think Jorgie flew for everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The early years.
And ran Cat for Jim Construction.
Yeah. Drag line, everything. Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, he says driving Cat was paid a hell of a lot more than airplanes.
That doesn't make sense to someone like me.
No, it doesn't. Not to anybody.
Well, maybe we have time for one more story. Can you think of any of the recoveries you did that stick out in your mind that maybe we don't necessarily have pictures of? I know there was you did a recovery up on Beaver Creek. We had some pictures of that one.
That was Art Olson's 180. Didn't know any pictures or not. He was taken off in a Herman's Bar. And Herman's Bar, it's an old riverbed, part of Beaver Creek. There was. The lower end goes right into the river. And Beaver Creek, I guess you call it. Anyhow, and then there's a big butte sticking up right across from it. But you have to take off that direction because the upper end is all soft sand. Well, Art had three people and a lot of gas. He took off the wrong direction, got into sand and bogged him down and slew it off and went into a gully. Nobody got hurt. And the airplane was damaged a bit. So we went up and used a come along or two and a couple of shovels and dug it out and got it up on the flat ground again. Started patching things up. While I was repairing the stabilizer, Cy Fouts was with me, young Cy. He was flying me back and forth. He says, "How do you like this?" And I went and looked and to fix the engine mount, which had been kind of discombobbled. He got a come along in there and a few odds and ends. come along, had to take the towel flap off since the come along handle had to stick out somewhere, so that was hanging out of it. Put the prop on, squared it away, and everything else. Then he flew it in that evening. It was just a couple days. And we just flew in and back out again each day.
Were you ever much of a fisherman?
I tried. I used to take fishing gear with me, and I never had a chance to get a line wet. Then it was just work from then on. It's like I said, I was going over to Kotzebue to help Max and Aviation out. I think it was there 2-3 times before I finally said, "Hey, Buck, I want to see the rest of this town." It's dark and winter. And I'm out at the airport, and then I'm down his place, holed up and sleeping. And, that was it. It was dark all the time, and the wind was blowing all the time. So he took me for a tour one day after lunch. About 10 minutes later, he says, "Well, that's about it. We better go back to work."
You spent quite a bit of time up in Kotzebue, huh?
Yeah, I used to go up and help Buck out all the time. We'd do repairs or what we could, do 100 hours there. Mm-hmm. I'd do 2 or 3 of them, and then he'd bring the plane in to have a real good one done where it was warm and peaceful. And the system worked out quite well. Mm-hmm. By me going up there, he could keep on flying without going Fairbanks back and wasting a bunch of time. So it worked out nicely. At first it was just the 185 and 185 and a cruiser, I believe. And then maybe it was a couple 185s or 206. Forget now, it's a long back. That was in the 70s. And then he got a single otter, which turned out to be a really money maker for him at that time with the oil exploration. All this going on. He hauled all the people in the Red Dog and all their stuff with that otter on a little skimpy runway on top of a ridge. And then they got bigger and bigger, of course. Big runway and all. But, oh my. You want to see something silly? It's an otter with a big loader tire hanging on the side of it.
Isn't there a picture somewhere along the line? I'm not sure if it's Buck's otter, or isn't there an otter laying upside down?
Yeah, that was the otter, yeah. Mm-hmm. One of his pilots was hauling freight up to a USGS camp on the Upper Noatak, and he came in and lost it, and it went in the river upside down. And Buck was telling me about it on the phone, and I says, "Ooh, boy," and it's springtime. And he says, "Well, did you hurt the gear or anything?" He says, "No, I didn't use that very much." So I gathered up some equipment and went up there, and by that time the water had risen up. All he could see was the belly and the wheels. So he got out there and put a line on it just in case. The water's running muddy and fast and high. We couldn't do a thing. So I left the winches and stuff there, and block and tackle, all that sort of thing. Came back to town, and the insurance company had a fellow named Kippenham out of Anchorage who was real great at recovery airplanes. And he got up there, and they got her right side up, and he worked on it, and then the insurance company says, "That's it, no more." And Buck called up, and he says, "Come up here and fix our otter. If you don't get it out of there, I'm going to lose everything." Some about the payment plans and this and that. So, okay, so I went up there, and there it sat. And the engine was about 30, 40 feet away, sitting on the mount, looking horrible. So he slid it back to the airplane. Had a tripod made out of pipe slipped together. Got that squared away, got the engine back on. And before I put it up, I'm looking at that engine and wondering, what do we got here? We had a spare engine, but no way to get it there except in a beaver, and it had to been taken apart to get it in. Well, then reassembling it out there in this sandbar wasn't too good because you can't keep it clean enough. I pulled a cylinder or two off of that old engine, and it was wet, and it was rusty and sandy, and I'm looking and thinking, but it still turned over. They poured some oil and stuff in it and let it set. And got it on the airplane, Tried to flush it out a little bit more. Yeah, I did some other fuselage work to do, too. I think I had to get the fin and rudder on it. Yeah. And then, I slid the engine back using the come along, and it was sitting on a piece of plywood. So I got it back over there and got it on. Got it running. And then drained the oil and tried it again. Anyhow, we flew that engine back into Kotzebue. And there was so much silt in that airplane, even though it had been washed and washed and washed by Kippenham, that Buck said later it was the heaviest takeoff he'd ever made. He had a point picked out and figured if it don't start, we don't get off by there, we're going to have to do something. And mind you, this is in the fall, and it's getting a little cooler all the time. Anyhow, it broke off, and we went headed our way to Kotzebue. We get to Kotzebue, and the controls had just about frozen up from the sand coming out of everything. So instead of the runway landed on the cross runway, one that parallels the beach, the gravel runway. Then I had to jump out with a crowbar and jam it in the tailwheel to turn it so we could get turned around, run up. Buck didn't want to stop. Once he got moving, I run up and throw the crowbar and me in it. Now mind you, this has got no cowling. Wingtips are gone, windows are gone, it's covered with filth. And across the runway is Alaska Airlines, the whole loaded tourist. It looked like MGM over there for the cameras. And he came bellering and snorting up and got it over and parked. Somebody made a remark, one of the other pilots, well, geez, why don't you land right out in front here, Buck? I said, why don't you try the wheel? And he climbs up the side and grabs the wheel, and it don't move. And Buck is a very powerful fellow. But it was all he could do to turn that wheel by the time we got there. Well, I had a picture of him. There's silt all over his shoulders, instruments all cocked. He's sitting there thinking about, let's see, how do I do this now? But he worked on it a little bit after I left. Stopped here and I changed engines here. Put the new one on finally. And he took it down to Seattle and got it overhauled. The fellows that went out to help bring it back up and the people at the where they repaired it. I said, look at that. There's a big pile of sand and real fine stuff that I recognized. I said, ooh, where'd that come from? He says, the horizontal stabilizer, he says, it took 4 of us to carry that in there. One man can normally lift it without any problem.
It's all the silt.
Silt into it, yeah. We drilled 1-inch holes quite a few places and flushed it, but of course couldn't get it all out. I mean, the ribs and stuff like that in there.
On the engines you pulled from the bomber up across Mileson,
yeah,
just because it was sitting on a sandbar in the middle of the river, were they contaminated?
Oh, no. He'd actually landed in a little bit of a slough and slid up on the sandbar, which the props were on. But with all the cowling and stuff around, and they ride, you know, that's a mid-wing, you might call it. Mm-hmm. So the belly took most of it. And the engines, no, we figured they were all right.
Just as long as it's not in the water, the silty water.
No, yeah, God, that's the bad part. But they were dry as could be. And got them back to town. So I got them off and sitting upright and some lifting eyes on the shafts. And luckily, a Chinook came through. It was working up north. And they stopped at Merrick Helicopters, going to do some work. And they said, on a test flight, they'd go pick him up for me. Mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out how to get him out of there, and the only way to do it would have been in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So you're running across the ice and carrying on and all kinds of moves to make. And he picked them both up at once. Mm-hmm. And that's where I learned you do not grab the hook before it hits the ground. I was standing there with a loop of cable in one hand, and I reached out and grabbed that hook with the other. They had it right there. And then I picked myself up off the ground and hooked it up, realizing, okay, now it's discharged. The static electricity was fantastic. And then they picked them both up, and then I took the boat back downriver and met them that night to pay them. And they were over at one of the local hotels. I come wandering into the bar where they were. They'd meet me. And you're all three of them sitting there laughing. And he says, "We forgot to tell you one thing." I says, "I noticed right after I got up." But that went real well. Put the engines on another airplane. They flew for another year or two. Until they quit using the B-25s, I guess.
Do you remember when the, I don't know how long ago it was. I remember driving home one day, and right there about Rosie Creek Road, looking down in the river, and there was a plane upside down on a sandbar and a plane upside down on a channel between the sandbars.
That happened, yeah. There was a midair collision, and nobody got killed. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And both the planes crashed, yeah. Or I guess one of them landed. Flipped over. But yeah, it was a Taylor craft and something else. And, you know, they had a midair and survived it all. Now, that is luck.
Yeah.
That very seldom happens.
Have you worked on many planes that have had river accidents up here besides the one up for Buck, the Otter?
Let's see.
I was just thinking along the lines of all that silt. I imagine the Cannonau is just as
bad. Oh, Jesus. Oh, it's, oh yeah, it's something else. No. Usually they're on gravel bars. One on the Salcha.
What was the one on the Salcha?
Oh, it wasn't bad. It was 180, and a guy came roaring down river and didn't make the turn. And went ricocheting up. Busted up a wing a little bit, an aileron and his floats. So went up there and patched everything as best we could. And laid a bunch of logs down so he could get into the river. Again, water had dropped. Dead salmon all over the place. And he gave her a little power. And worked too good on those logs. He just about wrecked it again on the far side of the river, but managed and took off and ran it back down to the Chena and got it, put it right on a dolly before it could sink. Mm-hmm. They were pretty bad. Wasn't a hell of a lot we could do there. My first experience is using a battery pack drill on a job like that. The batteries don't last long enough is one of the early ones. You had to take the whole thing and charge it, not just take a battery out and change it. And it was something else to learn. Back to the hand drill again. There was, I think there was a couple pictures of that one and that stuff. Damn. You got to think back on all these things, and one will lead to another.
Was that beaver at Arctic Village the only infield recovery you did for Ween? Were there others? Or?
For Ween, yeah. Yeah, they just didn't have, you know, they didn't have too much problem that way. Mm-hmm. And usually it was so bad that there was a matter of just shipping it back in pieces. Mm-hmm. There was another beaver over on the West Coast, got banged up pretty badly. And actually it was, that's when I had Buck and I met working at Ween's. And he was over there at Kotzebue working there as a mechanic. And the seemed to just take it all apart. We're going to haul it out with a C-82 or something. And he tried to convince them that he could fix it like I had, but they wouldn't go for it for some reason.
Did Buck work for them as a mechanic after you had?
He came on, let's see, I started here about 63, and he showed up, I don't know, somewhere right in that area, 63, 64.
How'd he end up in Kotzebue?
Well, he liked it out of town, and it paid good. You could always carry on a bit. So he was at Nome, and then he was at Kotzebue. Kind of liked Kotzebue and seen it. And by that time, he'd got his pilot's license, and then he got commercial, so went into the flying.
Did you ever run it? I know you did, because you had pictures. Ray Hodges.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Ray's good people.
One of Dad's friends. He's working for one of the ConocoPhillips now.
Oh, be darned.
I think he's flying helicopters up north.
I heard he was got into helicopters. Yeah. I didn't know he was working for anybody, though.
The only reason I was able to figure out what Ray was doing, because he's friends with my brother on Facebook.
Oh.
He's got lots of pictures of him and Junie out in helicopters. And,
oh, I'll be darned.
And then I saw just the other day that I hadn't noticed before that he was, I think it's ConocoPhillips he's flying for, and I'm guessing it's helicopters. I don't think they have many planes up there.
Jeez, I don't know.
But I'm sure they have helicopters.
Yeah, I don't know. I hadn't seen Ray in ages.
Neither have I.
Let's see. I went down to that airfare one year. I might have seen him then. But that's about it.
Well, Jim, we have about an hour and 5 minutes left.